welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. And Pape Machinery has everything you need when it comes to ag and turf products. Go up and see them. If you need a mower or a tractor or implements, need service on your existing tractor or mower, they can do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you could give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. So there you go.
.com.
Yeah. So what do we got going today?
Well, you know, I'm trying to get my Skype to work so that I can talk to Travis in there, but hopefully he's calling our guest because our guest just gave me a little text thumbs up, so we've been playing phone tag with his voicemail. Not him. We want to play phone tag with him, actually. Today's going to be interesting. All right. Let's do a little homework here. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. And at that site, you will find archives dating back to, I don't know, a million years. 12, I think it is. We've done all sorts of topics. Last week, I'm terribly sorry, I was shot out of the saddle by the flu or something that involved a lot of unpleasantness. And so we had to throw together a show, and I guess it took you into the... I laughed. I said it was the Wayback Machine when I sent the show to the studio from last year, but apparently the second half of the show was from 2019.
Whoa!
So we went to the Wayback Machine and then the Wayback Machine. But it was time to throw in a little environmental policy. That's what we were going to do anyway. And so anyway, we're gonna talk to William Kay in a couple of weeks. He's got some good stuff on some environmental craziness because they've been getting a pass really from us. We haven't been talking about that so much. It's been all about China and marijuana and stuff. And today will be a little blend of both, a little environmental, a little marijuana, because. I think people realize there is some environmental degradation when you've got all these cartel grows out on our public lands, but now that we magically legalized it and that made that all go away. Yeah. Well, that actually didn't happen. That is fiction. And our guest today is eminently qualified to discuss that. He is Lieutenant John Norris Jr. He is retired from the California Department of, I'll never get rid of fish and game. It's the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Fish and Wildlife.
For so many years, we called you guys the Department of Fun and Games, and it was so much fun to say that. And then you changed it, and wildlife doesn't rhyme with anything fun. Okay, so I'll tell you a little bit about him, and I really do hope you go to the page for today. Today is June 19th, 2022, and I've put a couple of video clips up there that are really, really good on so you can see kind of what they do. All right, so I'm skipping to the bottom. I was going to tell you the book he wrote, but back to the bio. A California native, John grew up in a small town in rural Santa Clara County. The eldest of four, he and his brothers and sisters, the Wolf Pack as their mom coined them, developed a love for nature and the outdoors at an early age. He initially began college with the goal of becoming a civil engineer. So good that didn't work out. But during a winter break in his first semester, he met a fish and game warden in the backcountry of Henrico State Park on a backpacking trip and was instantly inspired to become one himself. Inspiration led to a certainty of purpose, and as soon as he got back to school, he changed his major to criminal justice and began pursuing a career as a fish and game warden for the state of California. He has a Master of Science degree from San Jose State in Criminal Justice Administration and a bachelor's from San Jose in that same discipline. Was inducted into San Jose's Justice Studies Alumni Hall of Fame in November of 2018. So, hard work and diligence had led him to a diverse career he had for 28 years. Beginning in 1992, he was hired as a warden for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, formerly Fish and Game, and retired in December of 2018 as a special operations lieutenant working directly at the state level, co-developing and leading his agency's first elite tactical unit, the Marijuana Enforcement Team, MET. So we're going to say that a lot, and that's Marijuana Enforcement Team, and developed the California Department of Fish and Wildlife Live's first sniper unit, a Delta team aimed at combating the most dangerous and environmentally damaging criminals working within California and throughout the nation. So if you are, if you're a web person, he has a website, johnnorris.com, and his last name is spelled N-O-R-E-S. And there's also a documentary coming out called Call Sign Trailblazer.com. I've got a link for that. And he has a terrific book out called Hidden War, and I've linked that also on the page. I knew he had one before, so he'll tell us about all that other good stuff. But just thought we should get all that out there in case, you know, people thought you just went out in a cartel grow a couple of times and saw a bunch of stuff and
took a couple of nature hikes.
Yeah, and, you know,
made you an expert.
Uh-huh. So I have no idea where you want to start, because it's just it's a big topic, and it's one I think people either, if they see it, they shouldn't, and if they don't see it, they should watch the video.
Yeah, first of all, Aaron and Trav, thanks a lot for having me on the show today. It's always good to discuss this with you. Appreciate the concern. And that whole intro kind of went back down memory lane then, way to the beginning. I hadn't really thought about those early years of starting the career way back in the early 90s and what inspired it. So thanks for that great lead-in, and just glad to be here today to talk about, all things environmental crime, all things cannabis regulation, the dark, the light, all sides of it, and how it's affecting not only the great state of California, my old home state, the Golden State, but really the rest of the nation.
Yeah. It always, you know, there are so many things. They start here and then continue on. And I should tell people, with all the trouble we have in Northern California, I had gone to a community meeting up in Doris, California. Used to be the place with the tallest flagpole in the country, and now they're only number two. Poor Doris. God bless them. That was their deal. Somebody felt the need to beat them on that. Boo. But we were up there at a community meeting where I ran into you, and I said, hey, Bill and I do this show on Sundays. You should come on with us, because this is right up our alley. And this is apparently Travis's last day as our engineer, so, you know, came in with pot, leaving with pot, so... Thanks for bookending his
Travis
tenure.
Travis came in with pot?
Yeah, but he never smells like it, which is good.
Well,
he just
good.
Thinks it's funny.
Yeah.
And he plays his funny music. So was it as bad when you got started, just out of curiosity? Because I would think so.
You know, Aaron, it was always there. And what was interesting is, you know, the last thing many of us, if not most of us, on the fish and game warden front, and I agree, after being, you know, changing our name to the Department of Fish and Wildlife, it's been over a decade now, I still want to say fish and game, and I still feel like we are game wardens, you know, through and through, and it's quite an adjustment. But when we were game wardens and now wildlife officers, combination of both, in the early days, the last thing anyone ever envisioned was the thought of game wardens going out and going into trespass grow sites, you know, dealing with cartel grows, with EPA banned poisons in the water on these plants, you know, tainting these plants, going out to the black market all over the country, not only, you know, the western side of the U.S., but the Midwest, the eastern seaboard, things like that. And we had no idea the egregious environmental crimes associated with that type of crime. So I certainly didn't think I'd be doing that type of job. And for it to become a specialty, you know, and now in the Department of Fish and Wildlife, approximately one-fourth, if not more, of our entire law enforcement division, force of game wardens, are committed to cannabis enforcement. They're part of the cannabis enforcement program since we regulated under Prop 64. And I like your lead-in when you said we were going to legalize this, we were going to break the black market, the cartels were just going to go away, you know, grab their kickball and go home, and it was going to end. And certainly it's sadly been completely the opposite. The black market has absolutely, you know, exploded. The way we've regulated under Prop 64 has unfortunately incentivized the cartels and other transnational criminal organizations like the Hmong and the Chinese cartels that we really were dealing with in Doris when I spoke at that town hall meeting, had the privilege of meeting you for the first time and getting to break that down a little bit to get here today and talk about it. So this has become a huge issue for environmental crime fighters. Resource agencies, Forest Service law enforcement officers, Bureau of Land Management, LEOs, We on the state side, as far as game wardens go, and being retired and really working throughout the entire country now with other conservation groups and other border, you know, control groups, where this is a problem in many other states, not just California, because as we start to regulate state by state by state, we unfortunately are still continuing to incentivize a black market and get this, you know, trans-state, kind of between state lines, transport and sales and illegal, basically black market movement of cannabis nationwide. So it's a problem everywhere, not just in the Golden State.
So you naturally attack this stuff on the public lands. Do you have any ability to go after these private property grows?
Yeah, we certainly are doing a lot of that. And one thing we saw when Prop 64 passed, and we're looking at 5 years since Prop 64 passed. So 5 years has been a really good litmus test of what trends have we seen kind of change with especially black market, cartel, and other transnational organized crime groups. And certainly the outdoor trespass grow on public lands and national forests, it's still going on, much to what we're hearing to the opposite through certain sources. That is still very much a problem. The EPA banned poisons, the carbofuran, that's smuggled up across, you know, through the southern border, that's been banned by the EPA for use in this country. It is still being used in public wildlife areas on black market cannabis by the cartels. That's going out all over the country, and you know, certainly a slow poisoning effect of anybody who's ingesting this stuff unknowingly. But what we've seen since regulation is also a movement to private land. And a movement to both indoor and or outdoor hoop houses, private land entities, because cartel groups and criminal groups, and we saw this up in Doris, especially with the Asian cartels, is they don't really need to go out deep into the forest and hide when they can kind of hide in plain sight and do business on their private land, knowing that law enforcement groups, especially marijuana enforcement teams, whether it be the Department of Fish and Wildlife's cannabis enforcement program guys and gals, or it's Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office and all the old MET partners I got to work with, Aaron, when you and I met on some raids a few days after you and I met. And I'll tell you guys, I'm fully, you know, aware of the issue, and I still speak to it nationally now and continue to try to fight the fight for the environment, especially as well as public safety. But in the 3 years I've been out of operations, it was absolutely mind-blowing to see how bad it's gotten in Northern California, specifically in that hotbed area of Siskiyou County, because it is the Wild West up there. There is so little law enforcement to do a job for a humongous county that has so many pristine resources and so much mountainous and beautiful waterways and terrain and habitat. And that's why it's been picked by these organized crime groups, because they know under the law as it's structured now, they can go up there, and if they do get their property raided with a search warrant for law enforcement to come onto private property and eradicate illegal plants, and then also make arrests if they deem feasible, that it's very unlikely with the massive amounts of illegal grows up in Northern California throughout the whole state that you're going to really get in trouble. And if you do get busted, you're going to lose your plants. It's going to be a misdemeanor. You're very unlikely to be prosecuted unless you're one of the biggest fish, you know, in the ocean doing the crime. So it's just a matter of losing that multi-million-dollar cash crop and moving on to the next property to go and do it again.
Are they getting prosecuted for the environmental violations, the chemical spilling and fuel on the ground and that sort of thing?
Fortunately, they are, but it's not every county. Every county doesn't have the infrastructure, and they don't have the time and the staff to, you know, do a lot of environmental crime cases. And if they do, they're doing a handful compared to the many hundreds or thousands of egregious environmental violations that are out there. Well, we see it in the outdoor grows with the cartels, the EPA banned poisons in the waterways, you know, fertilizers leaching into waterways, habitat destroyed, like you said, fuel, propane, human excrement, all these things in encampments, just creating a bunch of environmental damage and destroying wildlife. We see that on the private property illegal grows as well. And what I saw firsthand in Siskiyou County is kind of a refresher when we were, you know, in and embedded with Sheriff Jeremiah LaRue's marijuana enforcement team up there, was water diversions, water poisoning.
Yeah.
You know, we saw, right, Aaron?
The volume of water is just, and you guys listed it in some of your video. I hope you have... You had a bunch of stats in one of your videos, and I meant to write them all down. I didn't. If you have that list before we get off the air today, let's make sure we give the people those numbers, like how many guns you guys collected up, how many busts you made. I mean, all that stuff, pounds of trash and all. It was mind-bending. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come right back with our guest, Lieutenant John Norris, and we are discussing, well, we're talking about all the things about illegal marijuana growing, but I titled the show the same as his book, Hidden War. Today is June 19th. Sorry, I time traveled. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. I love that song. Never get sick of it. So something about the ugly side of all this. And you know what? The ugly side of all this cartel dope stuff, there are people who have information about all of this. They know who's doing what with whom. We had a guy call in a couple weeks ago who was a contract confidential informant and gave quite a bit of information during the program. And so there are people out there that are willing to give up a lot to make this stop.
Well, I just don't think a lot of people realize how big it is and how much of it's going on. You know, you don't hear. You know, prior to reading your book, John, I was kind of wondering, what are we doing about all these public lands that you just can't hardly even go on anymore, with the fear of being shot or stumbling into some area that is very dangerous.
Yeah.
But it's nice to know that we are actually doing something, and from reading your book, it looks like we're making a dent in it, aren't we?
Yeah, I certainly think we are. I mean, the marijuana enforcement team, the unit that I helped stand up and was very fortunate, was the lead for the first years of its start up until I retired in 2018. Those guys and those canines are still working relentless on the outdoor public land trespass grows. They're not going away. And then you have, 100-ish officers with California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Cannabis Enforcement Program, which MET falls under. But those are all the private land teams that are really hitting where a lot of this environmental crime and a lot of this water stealing, Aaron, like we saw together, you're very versed on what's happening in Northern California. That's mostly the private land cannabis enforcement program teams that are handling that. And that's really become the majority of the problem out there now, because it's just... it's not necessary for all of these cartels necessarily to go way out on public lands, which unfortunately they still are doing, because they can kind of hide in plain sight. They've got good water. They can stay kind of, clandestine. They can stay camouflaged from law enforcement and the public. But they're doing the same amount, if not more, work and damage on private lands now as well.
Well, and the legal risk is so much less on private lands, too.
Yeah, because, see, it's still federally illegal. Like, when I lived over in Humboldt County from, 79 1989 to 1991 or so, I mean, you had to really pay attention if you went out, even on roads in, you know,
right.
like old logging
right.
roads and stuff like that, because it was all being grown on public land. And I was never a fan of legalization, but I thought, well, maybe when they do that, maybe they'll stop destroying the public land and they'll move it to private. But, you know, over there, just the environment, you know, the fog rolls in, they have lots of water, it's really green, all year round. You don't have the problems you just don't have to use as much chemical. You wouldn't have to, although they do. But that's such a great place to grow, always has been. And then you guys, were you pre-camp, the campaign against marijuana, whatever P is, planting program?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the camp program, the DOJ, you know, kind of task force camp program, we came in. We started officially involving and putting officers into the camp program. In fact, retired Chief Nancy Foley took a progressive step and assigned three officers in 2005 to join up with the camp teams to really go in and test the waters to see what we were missing. Like, do game wardens really need to be involved with sheriffs and Forest Service and DOJ agents, you know, in eradicating this stuff, because we weren't fully apprised of the depth of the environmental destruction. And water stealing wasn't the biggest issue then. It was the EPA banned poisons like carbofuran, what they do to the plants, what they do to waterways, what they do to animals and people that ingest them and that kind of thing. And then we started to see how much water cannabis takes, like any crop. And we're not putting a disparaging thing saying, you know, cannabis is the evil water stealer. I mean, most agriculture for our fruit and our vegetables take a lot of water. But when we're talking about illegal cannabis, you know, of millions and millions of plants on a huge magnitude, that is stolen water, obviously, no matter where it's coming from, if it's an illegal plant. And we were starting to see after 2005 and around 2008, 2009, 2010, when we were, you know, starting to get into the first of, you know, the first of many, you know, massive droughts we've had in California since, two large ones, century, you know, pretty much century significant. And we realized how much water was being stolen and how many billions of gallons of water were being depleted during a drought-stricken California. And that really got Governor Brown's attention at the time, that this wasn't just an environmental crime. It wasn't just the occasional bad guy with a gun out there growing black market weed. Now we were talking about toxically tainted weed that was stealing billions of gallons of water over a period just in California alone. And that started to kind of wake everybody up. And now what we're seeing, and Aaron, you guys made a good point just now, is on private land, water is getting very hard to find in drought, right? We saw that in Siskiyou. We see that in Shasta. That's why, you know, public water tanks for drinking water for a city are literally being, you know, basically taken over in the middle of the night by these illegal water trucks, as these organized crime groups are, you know, sending multiple trucks out to take 50,000 gallons of, you know, a Siskiyou County city's water supply, because they can't get it unless they dig an illegal well. They can't get it trucked in some dry, arid places. So some of these outdoor grows, especially from the cartel standpoint, are still going to happen because they can get on the headwater of a pristine waterway 10, 15 miles up the canyon of the National Forest, and they're not going to be fighting over water. They're going to have the water they need. They're going to be taking very delicate water, some of the most sensitive that we don't want impacted because of the origin of the drinking water, the snow runoff, say, from Mount Shasta. And I use that Doris Siskiyou County area as an example. When you have, you know, one of the tallest peak really next to Mount Whitney in our state, and you have all that glacier water melting, feeding all of those pristine creeks, basically surface water for farmers, for drinking, for communities, getting down into the groundwater source for our wells, and you're depleting that massive amounts, you're hitting the water source at its worst when you're taking that water for illegal cannabis.
Yeah, and the state now is doing curtailments on the agriculture community and the ranching community.
Right.
They're doing all these curtailments because they're the ones that are using all the water, and I'm thinking, eye on the ball, boys.
Yeah, tell our listeners how much water it takes to grow a marijuana plant.
And, you know, that's a great question, because that is the hotbed question that's been going through circles now for the last decade. And since I've retired, it's become a really, really hotbed question on politically, because of drought effects, right? And does illegal cannabis, water stealing in California have an impact on the drought. And we've heard different things. And my old agency, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, my alma mater, is saying that they don't see a significant impact on the drought from this water stealing. And then you've got the other side of people in the field seeing the massive levels of destruction. Environmental sciences like Integral Ecology Research Center, Dr. Murad Gabriel and Greta Weigert, that, you know, we do a lot of work together, and they're seeing this not only in the Forest Service outdoor grows, but they're going behind raid teams to reclimate and do soil samples and, you know, water quantity loss. But we don't see how it cannot affect the drought, simply because we know how much illegal cannabis is still going on private land, and it's taking a lot of water. And when I break it down, when you look at the science on it, and you look at, like, IERC's data, the average, and this is an average, and it can ebb and flow, outdoors versus indoors, you know, moist, arid temperatures versus very dry, inland versus coastal air, and like you said, the foggy, you know, coastal side of the meadow, yeah. You're looking at about 5 gallons per plant per day through the cycle on the average. And in our Call Sign Trailblazer documentary, we've been very fortunate to interview now regulated growers that were once in the black market in the 215 era, other growers that were black market and can't get through the permit process to be regulated because of the red tape, so they're just giving up. And then actually a trespass grower that was a guerrilla grower and was actually rivaling areas for cartel use where they were kind of at odds with each other, doing the trespass grow thing but non-cartel. And from all of that experience, from what that informant revealed, and we're going to go into this on the documentary very discreetly with security protocol in play, is 5 gallons is that kind of, you know, magical number on the average, give or take. And so when a marijuana plant in the outdoors or the indoors, illegal, whatever, private land or, you know, trespass outdoor public land, that plant is going to be in the ground approximately 90 days from, you know, basically planting, whether it's a clone or seed, to harvest, or maybe as long as 275 days. So there's this widespread depending on the strain. And so the amount of water can be a lot more egregious if it's a strain of cannabis that takes 7 months to see a yield, and it's sucking, you know, water on the average of that much for those whole 7 months versus one plant that does it for 3 months. But the bottom line is, whether it's 2 gallons per plant per day or 10 gallons per plant per day, or you average it out at five, it's a whole lot of zeros when you add it up with thousands and thousands and millions of plants that are not getting interdicted, that are stealing water all the way to harvest, because we have just, you know, the black market is oversaturated law enforcement's efforts to make anything but a small percentage dent in it, in California especially. So the water loss is incredible.
Well, and you,
you add all those
chemicals to it, and you're not producing a food product. You're not producing anything that benefits anyone.
Exactly. And then the other thing you're doing is you're taking a handful of legitimate growers that are doing everything by the numbers. They're basically on the grid. They're under water restrictions just like the rest of drought-stricken California is, you know, and they're taking it, you know, kind of in the shorts, if you will, like any legitimate farmer, rancher, or business folk that has to use that water, even for just their drinking and for their household use, and we're on drought restrictions, yet these illegal growers, which are, you know, yeah, massively outnumbering the legitimate growers in California, are under no restrictions because they're completely outlawed. No one knows how much water they're taking, and certainly that those drought restrictions are not applying to them in any way. So it's oxymoronic when you really look at what we're trying to do to curtail the drought on this water, you know, scaling down on water use.
And we're letting that go bananas.
And yet we're not treating the big problem as a massive problem of how are we going to get this drought back? How are we going to, you know, really protect water loss in California? And it's to take illegal cannabis at the massive amount it is and treat it as a serious priority, which sadly we're not doing. And as Sheriff Jeremy LaRue said, you know, I said, when I was interviewing him, guys, I said, Sheriff, today you just won the golden opportunity, lucky gold ticket on the California lottery. You can have anything you want to solve this problem here in Northern California. You're, you know, Wild West County, Siskiyou County. What's it going to be? He said, I've asked Governor Newsom. I've, you know, gone to the federal level. Treat this as a national emergency like you would a massive wildfire campaign. give us the resources and the people we need to stop the illegal cannabis. If you're a legitimate cannabis grower, doing it by the numbers, no issue. This isn't about cannabis. This isn't disparaging that any particular plant. It's the effect of what this is causing. So let's get smart and treat this as a priority and shut this down and come into Siskiyou County, Shasta County, maybe statewide. That's certainly not happening. I don't see it happening given...
They file state of emergency every single year, year after year after year, and the governor just blows them off. Got a few minutes before the break here. Before we leave the water idea, I'm sure we'll circle back to it, but before we move on and forget, when these guys are taking water, especially on public land, you can see it in your videos, and I forget which one it was in. It was in a couple of them, but one really explained it well. They put these tarps out. Maybe you could describe that for people, because I don't think they really – they're thinking they're using a pump and sucking it out of a creek and then
– putting it directly on the ground.
Yeah, putting it directly on the ground is no big thing. But the long-term effect on animals and all that with the way that they're storing the water and chemicals is something I think most people would not – they wouldn't think of that.
Yeah, it's a really good point to bring up, guys. And it's called what the cartels do. We call them check dams. And they basically create these above ground or, you know, ground level swimming pools by digging holes, lining them with bisqueen plastic, you know, cutting manzanita and oak trees and doing kind of a log stack and creating like a above ground pool lined with that plastic. And then they put some sort of barrier layer over it to save as much, evaporation loss and pump the water from the water source, whether it's a pristine creek or a stream or a lake, right to those check dams. And then those check dams usually have the Molotov cocktail of poisons in them, and they sit there and ferment and they leak. And so the water going from those check dams out into a grow site on drip irrigation to the base of the plants, all over the soil in the camp, is covered with numerous poisons, whether they're illegal or legal. And so obviously the water quality is completely decimated. Wildlife waterways are being completely polluted and destroyed. And then certainly when we as law enforcement officers, or heaven forbid the public, whether they be hikers, hunters, anglers, outdoor recreationalists, run across something like this, if they don't run across an armed grower that may do something, you know, to the death to defend that cash crop and not get caught, they certainly have the risk of poison exposure and tainted water, especially the EPA banned stuff. And we've had our dogs, our canines, you know, tainted with this stuff. We've had our officers go in and unprotected and grease some of it in or ingest it through contact or touch. It's one of the reasons why we, you know, run nitrile gloves and N95 masks and, you know, uniforms and long sleeves that we can decontaminate, go through decon protocol, because stuff's nasty. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely nasty. And what we saw, especially with this move, guys, indoors and onto private land, is those same banned chemicals and those same toxics are being used on the private lands, but they're even more concentrated. And I'm going to use some Siskiyou County raids we did with the sheriff's office.
Hold that thought. Let's take a really quick break, because it's the chemical thing is incredibly important. And when it's on private land, you can bring it in 55-gallon drums. You don't have to carry it in. So,
right.
So the quantity changes a lot. But we'll do more on that. On the animals, because I tell you, if you still think that the pot is wonderful and you haven't listened to any other show we've done about the how it causes cancer and birth defects, there's a new study out from Dr. Stuart Rees in Australia with the chromosomal damage and the birth defects that that all this is tied to. So if you don't care about any of that, but you like animals, you should keep listening, because that might give you a reason to want to step up against this. So, you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You see, tough times don't last. Tough people do. Tough people pull themselves up by the bootstraps when they hit hard luck. Do.
That could be your theme song. That would go nicely on your videos.
it kind of works. It's kind of spot on at home, you know.
Yeah, the adrenaline. So go back to the beginning of this this marijuana enforcement team, the idea that you guys created. I mean, I think you probably got into it as, you know, let's go be game wardens and we'll stop poachers and stuff like that. And then it's like, holy crap, these guys have AK-47s and they're like legitimate criminal
and
cartels.
They're actually killing more animals than the poachers.
Yeah. And so you're like, we're kind of outgunned. So you create this this kind of this fighting force, but maybe throw in a little bit about the dogs, because watching what was her name? I want to call her Penelope, and that's not right. What was it?
It's close. They both start with a P, but a PH. It was Canine Phoebe.
Phoebe. Yeah.
And I think you saw the trailer to one of the documentaries.
She was in tons of videos that you have posted, and man, she was fast, really fast.
She is amazing, and something. And guys, kind of going back to the beginning. Yeah, we didn't know this was the direction we were going to go, but certainly when I started to see the damages, and I was in my first cartel trespass growth site, my home county of Santa Clara, right below Henry Coast State Park in the headwaters to Coyote Creek. One of my, longtime friends that I grew up with that was doing his master's thesis as a fisheries biologist on endangered species in these creeks had found a dried up creek in the middle of April and called me, and we went into it and we stumbled into this embedded, had been there for a long time, cartel grow, two arm growers. Certainly didn't look like they belonged there. The plants were small. Not your, sedate, typical water diversion that I was used to as a traditional game warden. And that kind of clued in what was going on. And, we didn't lead that raid, but we jumped in with drug task force groups and multiple other agencies to kind of bird dog and guide them in there and then see how business was done. And certainly we learned that nobody was doing anything about the environmental crimes. They weren't reclamating or cleaning up the growth sites, removing the water diversions. We didn't know anything about the EPA banned carbofuran-based poisons they were smuggling from across the border all over these grow sites. And then fast forward a year later, I'm working with the same great sheriff's department officers that, would kind of become brothers for life a year later on August 5th, 2005. And Aaron, like I'm sure you've seen in Hidden War, I referenced this incident, but I talk about it in depth in my first book, War in the Woods. Three game wardens, two wardens that worked for me as a recently promoted lieutenant, and three sheriff's deputies in the Silicon Valley, actually the town of Los Gatos, foothills above the tech capital of the world. We go in on a raid. We get ambushed. It's a much bigger grow than we think it's going to be. There's armed gunmen all over that thing. Defending is they're in the middle of harvest time. And my partner warden takes an AK-47 round through both legs, and now he's bleeding out of four holes, losing massive amounts of blood. And we're waiting three agonizing hours for an air rescue to get him off that hill before he bleeds to death and dies. That changed the game for me personally and my partners, not only the wardens that were working that operation that day, but that was the year, like I mentioned before the break, that Chief Foley had dedicated three officers to the camp program that were doing camp eradication around the state at that time. And several of the guys on camp would later become MET partners that I recruit for the team that responded to that officer-involved shooting incident because it was one of ours. And that was the first time in the nation that any law enforcement officer had been shot at and actually hit or severely injured or potentially killed in the history of the country from these cartel growers. And now it was like, what the heck just happened? Yeah, we thought these guys were just trying to grow a little pot in the forest, make a little money, do a little trespass growing, a little piece of chong
surprise
thing.
And
quick education.
Talk about, immersed in the deep end of being educated now. And then the other question that came up with the governor's office and all the press crews, because we had national press coverage on that shooting incident that went over an entire weekend on that summer in August. And I'll never forget, the big question was, what are game wardens doing on a drug raid? What the heck are they doing there? They have no business there. But what no one knew was it wasn't about drugs and it wasn't about what cannabis was regulated or not regulated.
Yeah.
It was how dangerous these guys are, how much they're willing to go to guns to our American public, embedded here as deportable felons. They're not legal. They're part of criminal organizations with huge violent histories, and the environmental crime was more than I'd seen, and I'd been on over 15, 20 years at that point.
Well, the pictures that you guys have of
that egregious.
Yeah, you have pictures in your videos. You know, anybody doubts any of this, you've got all these pictures of, you know, dead foxes and rabbits and bears, big giant bears.
Ugh. And a lot of those same pictures, Aaron, are all, you know, the color section of my new book, Hidden War. The published Caribou Publishing was great about really making a color section in the middle to show how graphic this stuff is.
Yeah.
And really highlighting how, you know, what an amazing addition to the team and what the life-saving capabilities of these amazing canines like Phoebe and many others I can't name because they're still operational, and the cartels target our dogs now because our dogs are basically costing these cartel groups hundreds of millions, if not more, dollars with the, not only the operations they shut down, but also the growers that do try to get violent on us. And if they do have to be, you know, apprehended by one of our canines, they take that grower out of circulation for a while. So our dogs are targeted. They've gotten very effective. And the whole idea of building Met was trying to do the job safe and effective and come home and then be effective enough to do it again as good as we did it before with the help of the dogs. And in Hidden War, especially the new book, I talk about a very close call where I was dealing with a dog bite. The second chapter of that book goes into a cartel grow site literally in the foothills of where I grew up, a stone's throw above U.S. Reservoir in my hometown of Morgan Hill, California, South Santa Clara County, South Silicon Valley. And here we are going face-to-face with two armed growers in harvest time. And Canine Phoebe and her handler, Brian, and I are handling the whole dog situation. And we've got two guys with guns, and the dog can only handle one guy. So now we're having to go hands-on with guys pulling guns, deal with a guy that's got a gun hidden in his waistband, a Russian military pistol that he's trying to pull on me as the dog is keeping him under bite duress. And that's the only reason I'm not shot in the face is I'm approaching the suspect to contain that suspect. Well, my handler has to deal with another guy hands-on who's pulling a gun, and he can't tend his dog anymore because now we have two threats and we have a whole team behind us that not only are we going to be exposed to gunfire at, you know, several feet away, basically contact distance, but now we're going to be dealing with all the other threats to our officers behind. So when that happened and that dog saved my life personally, and I had already heard the stories of Phoebe saving multiple hundreds of lives on other operations in Northern California, where Brian worked primarily with her in Shasta County in Northern Cal, up in the neck of the woods where we met Aaron, I realized we need these dogs on every mission we do related to this, and we definitely need a dedicated team of the people that do it correctly and have had a lot of experience learning the wrong way, making mistakes, and learning the best we have from other agencies and developing our own tactics. And that's when Chief Mike Carrion at the time in 2013.
I know him.
Blessed myself. And now, yeah, you know Mike.
Mike was a great guy. Yeah. He came in one time. We were having tons of problems with Fish and Game. I mean, it was like every 2 seconds they were calling me at work, you know.
Uh-huh.
We had another thing with a game warden. And so Mike calls me, goes, I want to meet with you. I go, I don't think you're going to like it, but sure, I'll meet with you. But I'm not. I mean, if you just want me to tell you what a great job you guys are doing, you picked the wrong person. And so he goes, no, I'll come in. So we did what we called, we made it Operation BFF. I would, if it was guys on our side that were being bad, that were doing bad things, then he called me and told me and I went and looked into it. And if it was guys on his side that were roughing up the citizenry, then I called him and said, are you guys roughing the citizenry? And he'd go look into it. And so we had like this tremendous truce between the landowners and the Fish and Game guys for as long as he was there. It was great. He was wonderful.
Yeah, you know, Aaron, it's funny going back down memory lane. I can't remember if it was during Nancy's tenure, right when Mike took over as chief and Nancy retired, but I remember Doug had questions about equipment we were buying on new binoculars, and we went to the new POF AR, 10 platform to improve our rifle system. And there was a big expenditure involved in that. And I was one of the officers from the firearms committee that was sent over, especially because of the Met experience, to talk to you and your staff on why this stuff is important for game wardens to have it. And it was a really great meeting. Everybody was really receptive. They kind of got it. And it was basically the Met examples of the gunfights we had been in, why we needed this equipment, and this was as Met wasn't quite formed yet, but those issues were even coming up legislatively, you know, with
sure, because there's cost involved. They have to appropriate for it.
Absolutely, and you guys were fantastic, and I know Mike had mentioned real good things of working with you guys in the past.
Well, it was funny because
from your camp, wow, it's been great.
I remember asking him, I'm like, so are you just like some flunky? He goes, no, I'm actually their boss. Because I was like, I can't get this lucky. You can't be in charge of anything. What, you know, like, what are you in charge of? And he goes, well, I'm in charge of a lot of stuff. And that was before he was promoted to, like, I don't know, the head of a whole bunch of people. And the one day he calls me up, he goes, well, I got another promotion. I'm like, is this a good thing? He goes, yeah, I'm in charge of a lot more guys. I was like, well, we might have just saved the whole district. And then he disappeared. I was crushing blow.
Yeah, we had him for 3 amazing years.
And yeah. If you ever see him, tell him I said hi. He was a good guy.
I will. Yeah, he and his wife are in Hawaii now, and we talk a lot. They're sort of enjoying retirement, but that guy never slows down. But I'll definitely pass that along.
Yeah, because I mean, it really went both ways. He had a guy that was a big pain. He was up by Doris, actually. They called him Babyface, and I get all these phone calls. Babyface is spying on me again. Babyface is doing. And I called him. I go, there's some Babyface guy. Who is this? He goes, I know exactly who it is. And yeah, he fixed it. I thought, see, that's the cooperation. Like, that's how that's supposed to work. But the people, for anybody who's listening, who wants to watch Phoebe in action, Brian, the handler, called her the fur missile at one point.
Yeah,
and when you watch her, like, chase these people down and then jump at them, it's like, oh, my God, she did look like a fur missile. I don't want the fur missile coming for me.
We called her the fur missile. She was the sweetest, loving, most non-aggressive dog, would chest bump and run around with my yellow companion canine lab since she was a puppy. But when it was time to go to work, she was all business. And she got really good at being awesome at being silent, never mistaking an officer for an armed suspect that she had to apprehend. And she was one of those one-in-a-million dogs, and that's why I highlight stories about her, especially in the new book, especially, because we got her dedicated to the team. And when Mike took over as chief and we sidebarred and I said, you know, this is really something I think we need, Chief, and it's not just creating a little, you know, ninja group of black ops game wardens. This is a dedicated issue for the resources of California, and there's guys that are trained and ready to do it, but we just need to do it. We need to do it correctly. We need to go all in or step out.
Yeah, otherwise people get hurt.
Exactly, Aaron. We're dancing with death every mission. And I can't tell you how many close calls we had to getting shot or stabbed when we didn't have the dog because we're in an apprehension, we're going hands-on, we're seeing guns. And then you get into the situation where that gun's presented on you and you don't have a choice if you want to survive or you want to save the lives of your partners. Now you're involved in a gunfight. Now everything's gone, terminal, there's no going back. And one thing these dogs have done is, even though there will be some injury to the suspect that's pulling that weapon, it's a non-fatal injury on a dog bite, but everybody goes home. Mm-hmm. There's not a shot fired. And, you know, we've been involved either collectively or individually in 6 officer-involved shootings since that first gunfight I was involved in when our partner was shot in 2005 up until 2017. And one of the last chapters in Hidden War goes into that last gunfight we had over in Sierra Azul in Santa Cruz County and how crazy that got, but how safe it was, how the officers were contained, how having 3 dogs on that mission saved everybody, and it was just a well-oiled machine compared to what had happened over a decade before when our officer was shot and almost didn't make it off the hill. So that's what justified this team. That's what was a big professional progressive step for the agency and having leadership that believed in us, because it would have never happened if we didn't have progressive-minded leaders like Nancy Foley and Mike Carrion.
To put this all together, we have to take a quick break for the news, and then we're going to come back and talk some more about this. But here's one for Phoebe. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Ow! Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good.